Letters of John Hus, written during his exile and imprisonment, with Martin Luther's prefix, and contain a general view of the works of Hus, by Emily Day Bonnichos, translated by Campbell McKenzie, dated 1846, being read by Peter John Parisis. Introduction. Towards the end of the 14th century, there was born in Bohemia a man whose name is inseparably connected with one of the most important revolutions of modern Europe. His history I have narrated in a preceding work. Footnote: The Reformers Before the Reformation, 15th Century, John Hus and the Council of Constantine, 2 volumes, and a footnote. I there placed before my readers the great events of the memorable epoch and exhibited, on the stormy stages of the world, this Christian whose death, even more than his life, agitated his country and all Germany. My object in the present work is to complete the first, to finish the portrait of the illustrious reformer of Bohemia by making him also known in his domestic life, the infusions of his private intercourse. The man is completely revealed in his correspondency, and I here publish all that the friends of Hus have handed down to us. These letters, which are translated now for the first time into our tongue, were never intended for the public eye, having been addressed by Hus to his disciples and friends, to be pursued far from the view of his enemies and used under the shade of domestic roof. They furnish most precious documents to history and are unquestionably testimonies of the spirit and character of the author, though they are not remarkable either for profundity of thought or for style and singularity of doctrine. There, nevertheless, exhales an innocent candor and an angelic piety, like a fragrant perfume, from every page. What especially pervades them are the Christian thoughts on the fall of man and his regeneration through Jesus Christ, the conviction that all the things of this world pass away, and are but the shadows of things external, that man is nothing without God, that there is nothing but darkness or false lights, wherever the divine flame does not penetrate, and lastly, above all these thoughts subsists that which embraces all the rest, that faith is life. We behold in his correspondency a soul superior to seduction as well as to terror, a firm and upright reason which penetrates every subtlety. Footnote. Consults in particular letter number 40 on the second series. End of footnote. Originates in the conscience alone, clings tediously to what appears to be the truth, as to man's most precious possession, as to the treasure which has nothing to fear, neither from rust nor robbers. Matthew chapter 6, verse 20. Hus was one of those spirits, more contemplative than practical, which, after having recognized an idea as true, admit of no medium or arrangement in propagating it, and concern themselves for the consequences not more for others than for themselves. The inflexibility of his character equaled his propriety of feeling, and it may be affirmed that, in all respects, both by the heart and intelligence, Hus was of the number of those who appear in the world as if predestined to martyrdom. Yet he sought not after it like a passionate sectarian or a blind enthusiasm. He was as far from possessing that pride which complacently feeds itself on its own conceptions, as from that sudden fanaticism which causes a man voluntarily to shorten his life by useless rashness through dint of persuading himself that death is desirable. Before entering into a contest with his superiors, John Hus hesitated, consulted, and examined. Visited with ecclesiastical censors at Prague, he knew not whether he should obey and be silent or continue to preach the gospel. I burn, says he, with an ardent zeal for the gospel, and my soul is sad, for I know not what to resolve on. Footnote, first series, letter number 3. End of footnote. At a later period, at Constance, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-C-E, when condemned and ready to die, he wrote, I exhort you in the name of the Lord to detest every error that you may discover in the world, but viewing in mind this truth which I have ever had in view, pray for me. Footnote, second series, letter number 48, and a footnote. He faithfully depicts his feeling in a letter which he addressed at the same period to the priest Martin, his disciple, an admirable letter, a true model of prudency in every Christian virtue. Quote, attach thy soul to the reading of the Bible, and especially the New Testament. Fear not death if thou desirest to live with Christ, for he has said himself, fear not those who kill the body, but who cannot destroy the soul. If they should trouble you on account of this adhesion to my doctrine, answer, I believe my master to have been a good Christian. In touching what he has taught and written, I have neither read nor understood all. Unquote. Hess was neither a superstitious man nor a visionary. Nevertheless, he had visions and received warnings in his sleep. He foresaw what came to pass. Footnote. Second series, letter 33. End of footnote. Yet refused to attach faith to his dreams. He does not dare to place trust in them and distrust his senses rather than slight the authority of the single precept of his God. He repeats his text, quote, place no confidence in dreams, unquote. And after having related them to his friends, he adds, quote, I write this not because I consider myself a prophet or that I would exalt myself, but to show I have suffered bodily and mental temptations as well as a great fear of transgressing the commandments of the Lord, unquote. Resignation was predominant in his mind. The most absolute submission to the divine will as well as an ardent desire to become acquainted with it. Pray, says he, fervently to the Lord, that he may grant me his spirit, and that I may dwell in truth and be delivered from all evil. If my death should add to his glorification, pray it may arrive speedily, and that he may enable me to support my ills with consistency. But should it be better for my salvation that I return amongst you, we will employ of God to enable me to return from the council without a spot, viz. That I may keep back nothing from the truth of the gospel of Christ, in order to be enabled to discover more surely its light and bequeath to our brethren a good example to follow. The sacrifice which he made of his life was the more inexemplary, and his martyrdom the more sublime, because he had felt beforehand all the terrors of death. It was in God that he sought for support against them. Beseech the Lord to grant me the assistance of his Spirit, that I may confess his name, even unto death. I shall stand in need of his divine aid, although I am confident he will not suffer me to be tried beyond my strength. Footnote, Second Series, Letter 11, in the footnote. His confidence in God did not forsake him till the very last moment. Our Savior, says he, raised Lazarus from the dead after the fourth day. He could also snatch me from prison and death. I, an unfortunate man, if it were for his glory, for the advantage of the faithful and my own good. Footnote. Second Series, Letter 38, and a footnote. And yet, when in chains and awaiting death, he is more occupied with the interests of others than his own. His soul, calm, pious, and compassionate, sympathized with all around him. His jailers were exhorted and instructed by him. He thinks with tenderness of his disciples and of the faithful believers of his church and of his friends, and the sight of his benefactors draw tears from his eyes, and he writes to them in these touching terms. Generous señores, my comfort and faithful defenders of the truth, you whom God has sent me as my angels, I could not fully express how much I am grateful for so much consistency and for all the charitable kindness you have shown to me, a weak sinner, but servant in hope of Jesus Christ. Footnote, Second Series, Letter 18. His poverty being great, he regrets not being able to remunerate his friends who have assisted him with money. He bequeathed them all his possessions, which is but little. For the surplus of his debts, he addresses an appeal, with a confidence altogether Christian, to all who are rich, and conjures them to pay for him those who are poor. He promises them, in exchange for the worldly riches which they advance to him, spiritual and imperishable wealth. Footnote, Letter 25, end of footnote. Every word that falls from his lips or his pen affords signs of that virtue so well defined by the apostle, of that charity so mild, patient, and benevolent, to which nothing is indifferent, because in everything it finds an opportunity of exercising itself useful and fulfilling a duty. At the approach of death, he feels his ardent zeal redoubled for the salvation of his brethren and dear disciples, and includes in the same solicitude all those who have listened to his preaching. and in his last exhortations no one is accepted. When on the point of appearing before the King of Heaven, all earthly distinctions vanish before his eyes, and the soul of the obscure workman is to him as precious as that of the monarch. His own soul presents an unalterable calm amidst the most cruel pains, and sometimes unbends to a sweet and tranquil gaiety. Though a prey to so many outrages, he utters neither threat nor murmurs. He pardons his enemies. He blesses and adores the hand of God which tries him, and sees in these rigors only marks of his love. Shortly before his death, he writes to his own friends thus: "When we shall meet hereafter in a happy eternity, you will know with what clemency the Lord designs to assist me in my trials." Footnote, 2nd Series, Letter 30, end of footnote. Such does John Huss appear in the edifying letters of which we here present the translation, and it is impossible to pursue them without repeating with Luther: "If this man was not a generous and intrepid martyr and a confessor of Christ, certainly it will be difficult for any man to be saved." Footnote, Prefix of Luther, page 12, end of footnote. We have penetrated in every direction into this mind so eminent Christian. We have shown in all its aspects this soul so marked with candor and so powerful. And it now remains to us to assign to John Huss his place among the men who have agitated the world to determine the work which is personal to him, what, in fact, he has left behind him that is durable. To succeed in such an endeavor, we must take into account a prejudice which still prevails at this period. False notions had for centuries been in circulation and had taken root in Christendom relative to the authority of individual convictions, judgments, and conscience. It was denied that man, sustained by divine grace, could find in himself any assistancy. It was believed to be a meritorious act of Christian virtue to seek for no direction in one's own internal feeling and to trample reason underfoot. And opinion was adopted not because in itself it had been found conformable to the Scripture or to truth, but because it was considered to agree with the decisions of some great doctor, pope, or council, or because it was found in Augustine, Origen, or Jerome. Tradition alone was listened to, and it was altogether forgotten that the first Christians, who had sprung from the Jews and Gentiles, were accustomed to consult their conscience before all in the face of the altars of paganism or of the temple still standing in Jerusalem, and that they took for their own guide this secret and inflexible monitor. A few eloquent men, a few great minds, had, it is true, consulted with individual opinions, yet then yield to clerical and traditional authority. Abelard and Beringer in France had given proof of boldness and independence in proclaiming their doctrines, but they grew timid when it was necessary to defend them. Their voices died away, and their heads were bowed low before the menaces of popes and councils. In Italy, Armand de Bresse, B-R-E-S-S-E, had ventured openly to resist the pontiff's power, but the revolution of which he gave the signal was a civil rather than a religious one. Numerous sects and whole populations had, in different countries, emancipated themselves from the yoke by depending on that irresistible force with the sympathy of the masses and association with a whole nation creates, in order to think, believe, and suffer. England, in fine, had witnessed a powerful mind, that of Wycliffe, nourished by the Scriptures, bring to light a body of doctrine from which at a latter period sprung the code of the Reformation. Footnote. See the Reformers before the Reformation, History Introduction, Section 5. End of footnote. But Wycliffe escaped alive the solemn sentence of an clericalman council. Footnote. Wycliffe died 35 years before the Council of Constantine condemned his memory and works. End of footnote. And many doubt whether he could have passed triumphantly through that formidable ordeal. It was reserved for the little town of Constance, Constance, 204, a spectacle which the world had not witnessed for ages. There one man, weakened by sickness and long imprisonment, isolated from a few friends, dispersed and trembling, resisted, strong in the gospel and in his conscience, all that external authority could display to imitate in subjunctate souls. He, yields not before the efforts of all the spiritual and temporal powers united. John Huss lately, by his example still more than by his doctrines, reopened to the Christian world a path that had been long closed, and if it is permitted to compare sacred things with profane, effected in the sphere of religion and mortality what, at a later period, Columbus brought to pass in the external and physical world, he laid open a new empire, or, to speak more correctly, he discovered a domain which had been forgotten for ages, that of the conscience in matters of faith. Inquiry was a field interdicted to all. Huss entered on it anew and in the midst of hostile clamors, and he reopened it amongst the noise of the thunder and the tempest. He fell in his attempt, but it was important to prove that the conscience of the Christian was stronger than all the powers of the earth, for that and one of those sublime sacrifices which terminate in death was requisite. John Huss, therefore, must die, and in his death consisted his victory. It was the firmness of his character which gave him influence over the people, like most of those whose passage through the world has left the most durable impression. He was great especially by the heart, and although he was, by the qualities of his mind, one of the greatest distinguished men of his age, yet his greatness was rather moral than intellectual, nor attached his name to any religious creed, and his glory is, in consequence, the purer. Not being the author of his doctrines, he had no personal interest in his triumph, and the love of the truth did not, in his heart, confound itself with vanity. He was not able to obtain external liberty for religious worship, but he did more, for by his faith, by his courage, before a tribunal, the most elevated in the opinion of men, by the vast renown of his virtues, condemnation, and martyrdom, he caused a part of Europe to understand the sacred right of the freedom of conscience, which, when properly employed, constitutes the Christian virtue equally on the throne as in chains. John Huss, in a word, greatly contributed to bring back Christianity to its primitive character, viz., that of being the religion of the heart, and to restore its real spirit, the spirit of life, of progress, and of liberty. If religion be not this, if it be the monopoly of a college of priests or the privilege of a sect, it becomes immediately exclusive, intolerant, and oppressive. The history of antiquity as well as of modern times teaches us that men who constitute themselves as infallible interpreters of the divinity make their gods after their own likeness. The creator of the world would soon be no longer in their mouths a compassionate father who gives to all his children on earth an equal right of approaching him in adoration and prayer, and who presents his word to all minds like his son to regards of every creature, but a jealous master, ever ready to punish and strike at the will of his interpreters at the cry of those who call themselves the representatives of his power. Religion would no longer be that celestial and internal bond which attracts the soul to God by love. It would become the yoke which masters externally by constraint, a dreadful instrument of punishment to the souls which it abases by placing them under restraint, and more destructive, if possible, to men's minds than to their bodies. It is on this account that the generous Christians of all churches, who have heroically resisted the oppressors of the conscience, are justly entitled to the imperishable admiration and gratitude of all who adore us in spirit and in truth. Among these, no man was ever more remarkable than John Huss, for no other ever did more to restore to the conscience in the heart of man that throne which ought never to have abrogated. End of the introduction. Have been read by Peter John Parisis.